out of all the tools available to deliver digital health, which ones did we use successfully in the last few years? And what could have been done better? These are the questions that Keith Grimes came to talk about at the last eHealth University. Keith is a doctor with over 25 years of experience in primary care, but he is also a product specialist, having led clinical and product teams at Babylon. At the time, Babylon was one of the fastest growing digital health companies in the UK. Keith was generous enough to give us some of his time for this interview when he was in Castres and to share his views on what eHealth should really be focusing on and how we should approach it in the next few years. Keith, it's your first time here at the University of eHealth in Castres. You delivered a brilliant talk yesterday about the promises of digital health before and after the pandemic. Would you like to give us maybe a quick rundown of what you've been up to and what your background is?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, thank you very much for having me. And I'm delighted to be here because I love my digital health. I love coming to a place where people are very happy to talk about it and explore it. And why is this? Is because I am, my background is as a general practitioner. I'm a doctor, a UK-based doctor. I've been a doctor for 27 years, a general practitioner for 23 of those. But I have been in love with technology and the application of technology in healthcare for as long as I can remember. So now I work as a digital health and innovation consultant at my own consultancy, Curistica. My mission is to accelerate the automation of healthcare because, in short, we aren't delivering enough healthcare to people around the world. And to do that, I combine some things that are slightly unusual about my background. I'm a doctor, a general practitioner with an interest in urgent care, but I'm also very interested in technology and have done that within the NHS and within industry. But also the development of products and the use of artificial intelligence, what I've done at companies like Babylon. And then finally, through leadership. And this is about leading the current and future generations of doctors and healthcare workers to learn how to work well with health tech organizations to build effective products and services rapidly. So I combine all of these things together and have an enormously good time doing it. And so to come here and meet other people who feel the same is wonderful.
Well, it is great to have you. And yesterday you talked about the promise of digital health before the pandemic and after the pandemic. And essentially you said that expectations were very high. What came out of it, maybe not that much. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, sure. So in coming to this event and on the theme of the event, the e-health, is it an oasis or is it a mirage? It was very, very important for me to be able to talk and reflect on some of the big issues that e-health or digital health has been looking to address over the last few years. And what bigger event really than the pandemic? And when we start to look back at the pandemic, we want to try and learn from where we got things right, and also importantly, learn from where we didn't get things as correct as we should have. And going into the pandemic, it's very true that there was a great deal of expectation, a great deal of promise from what digital health was going to be delivering. But whilst there was definitely some successes, and we have changed how we practice, particularly with things like telehealth, it didn't quite live up to the expectations. So in my talk, I went through artificial intelligence, telehealth, and total triage, and then digital contact tracing. Tried to identify how well they did. We used a report card. I didn't give artificial intelligence a terribly good score, and people thought that was being quite harsh.
I personally didn't think that you were really harsh. You gave a D, I think, to artificial intelligence.
D plus,
yes. To artificial intelligence.
Clearly trying, but didn't quite live up to it, yes.
Contact tracing was a C.
Well, it was C, wasn't it? If I go through it, it was a D plus. I want to remember what I did now. I actually give telehealth a B plus because telehealth really has significantly changed things. But from the UK, there's been a regression from popular use. And of course, I was hearing in France that actually it's fallen back a great deal as well.
Yes.
For many different reasons. And then contact tracing, I put as a solid C. It did what it needed to do. But it was when it was combined with other technologies that it really succeeded.
Well, one of the big premises of eHealth is to get more patients through the door. So effectively freeing up some space, for the professionals, for doctors and nurses, and being able to then dedicate more of their time to more patients. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Freeing up time to care which is a phrase that Eric Topol used it, actually. Eric Topol, the US physician that is also working a lot in the digital health space, talked about time to care in his most recent book. I think it's really important to free up time to care for a number of different reasons. Now, number one, if we free our healthcare workers from some of the administrative duties, typing on the computer, you know, things that should be automated but aren't, it frees up more time for them to interact with the patient. Mm-hmm. That, I believe, is a very, very important thing, in part because the delivery of care, particularly continuous care or continuity of care, is based on three things broadly: informational continuity, management continuity, and then relationship continuity. And briefly, informational continuity is down to the data and making sure the data is in the right place at the right time and shared to the right people. Technology, yeah, great, no problem. Yeah. Management continuity, the ability for all of us in an extended team to provide a consistent journey for the patient and for them to be cared. Great, you know, we've seen many examples of this. Relationship continuity is that very human side of things. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to be one person, but it's about the opportunity for a person to be human with another person. And that takes time. You need time to do that. If technology frees up time to care, and all we do with that free time is put more patients into that space, how are we giving more time to that conversation? And that's an area that I'm increasingly concerned about. I'm working in this space to try and free up time. But given that we've got a lot of demand, it's going to be very, very tempting to just put more patients in. Now, if you combine that with the other great promise, which is that by using technology, we can help people operate at the top of their license. So the doctors, of which there's more limited resources, will be seeing the more complex things. And then we have other members of staff that deal with other things. But if everyone is constantly working at the top of their license, and the time that we freed up is being filled out with more patients, then what you have is you have a lot of people being forced to work at a very high level all the time. And that has severe consequences, I think. Consequences for the wellness and mental health of our clinicians, and we know already that they're being burnt out, but also the patients too. Mm. I think they still want some time. So I think that's a really important conversation we have to have, is that if we do succeed in getting time, we need to preserve that for actually spending time with patients.
You mentioned burnout. What's the situation in the UK around burnout?
The situation in the UK is pretty bad with regards to burnout. I spoke yesterday that in a report from the British Medical Association that I think it was 39%, I can't remember exactly, 39% of junior doctors, those are doctors that haven't become consultants in the UK, so they're not young, they're just in that journey, 39% reported high or very high symptoms of burnout. And that's a dangerous situation, because a burnt out doctor, it's not only bad for them, but it's also bad for the patients and bad for the systems. And I know this because I was burnt out myself in 2017. I became very unwell as a result of burnout. I was working as a general practitioner and had to spend 5 months off work, not only suffering from burnout, but the consequences with depression and anxiety. You know, when I talk about it, I often talk about depression as being the most impressive illness because of how awful it makes you feel. And it left me, thankfully, as I remain in recovery, it left me with a greater understanding of that patients go through. And I wouldn't wish it on anyone. So even just in a kindness sense, I don't want my colleagues and people that I work with going through burnout. But then, speaking as a manager or a leader in this situation, they're also terribly ineffective when people go off sick. How are you going to fill in the time as well? We're seeing huge numbers happening. And in part, we can teach resilience, helping people cope with it better. In part, we can try and make the system better. But ultimately, we have to make people work in an environment which is not going to make them burnt out. And that's hard because of the demands that we have on us. But it's going to be impossible if we are not honest about this and really try and deal with it. Hence my concern about just pursuing efficiencies, because that, I don't think, will help. I don't think it'll help prevent people getting burnt out.
One of the things that was mentioned during the 2 days here at Incastres is how patients take control, manage their own health and the access to care. Mm. So they come to a GP consultation much better prepared than they used to. And that, I suppose, puts more pressure on a doctor.
Yes, but we have to adapt. Now, there are some inconveniences, I suppose, from the doctor's side. You know, if I've got 10 minutes to speak to a patient and they come in with a notepad with a lot of things in there, or they send me a lot to read beforehand, you know, where's my time to prepare? You know, I was going moment to moment. So in the UK as a GP, I was used to working with 10-minute appointments, sometimes less.
Wow.
So it's very, very harsh.
Face-to-face or...
Yes, face-to-face or phone was less, but, you know, very, very busy. So this is why we need, you know, some space to there. Or we have a wider team. For me as a doctor, working with other members of the team in a practice with nurses, but maybe even data analysts and social prescribers and so on. The relationship the patient has is not with me on my own, but with that team. I then perform my part in some of the more medical sides of things, but maybe some of the more social aspects are captured elsewhere. And then all this data that's captured, either we use new technologies to help summarize it so it turns into something actionable, or we actually literally have doctors who work as data analysts, you know, the informaticians who consult with a patient and let's consider all your data. So when you come in for your conversation, which may be with more than one person at a time, we're able to give you a much deeper insight. And that might suit some people sometimes. Other times people might not be ready to have that level of discussion. We have to be flexible. But I think the thing that's interesting is about access to data, patients' access to their data. I've been hearing very positive things about patient portals. I've been hearing very positive things about what's been happening in France, actually, about people being able to get access to their data. But the question is that really access to their data? And are they able to make use of it? I'd be very interested to hear more about that and give a report card on what we're saying as well.
Yeah, we should make the report cards a sort of a leitmotif, something that comes up every year different subjects.
Well, I learned a lot, obviously, working in industry. We learn an awful lot about our goals, and unless you measure it, it doesn't really matter. And so finding some way of having a metric to see how we do and then say, this is what we hope to have. And then a year from now, well, how did we do? It's easy to forget about the promises that we've made. I learned a great deal as well about falling in love with the problem and not the solution. Mm-hmm. As a geek, I love my gadgets. I've got a gadget right in front of me. But the truth of it is that you don't lead with a solution. You lead with the problem. You fall in love with the problem. And so when people tell me about this great thing that they've built, the answer is always, well, that's very interesting, but what problem does it solve? Whose problem is this solving? And if you can't tell me very clearly whose problem this is solving, and not the problem is me, I need money for my company. It's like, which patient problem is it solving? If you can't do that, you need to think more deeply.
What do you think we should talk about next year? So what are the themes you think are either not being spoken about much today or will increasingly be discussed during the next year or maybe the next 2 years?
I think the thing that will most help us in delivering healthcare is to remember that as these technologies come along, it can be very interesting to use the technologies to make our existing practice more efficient or more scalable. Yeah. I often describe it as digitizing the status quo, as in how we're doing things right now, but we just have a digital version. So that's good, that's interesting, but it's not quite as interesting as making things that were previously not possible using technology. And so the scalability of technology makes that helpful. And I suppose the overarching point that I wanted to make in my talk is that the world is still waiting for its healthcare. I gave a stat that 50% of the people on Earth don't have ready access to healthcare. I'm not aware that has got any better. And when I see some of the solutions, with a few exceptions put out here, I don't see it meaningfully assisting that group. So I'd be interested to see what the impact of large language models like ChatGPT and similar, and the open models has on that community. I think that would be a very interesting area to look at. And not only look at the patients, but also look at those working in healthcare, building their own solutions. Mm. I'd be very interested to look at that. And then another thing, and we've talked a lot about it, either in this podcast, but here today as well, it's about the importance of getting this sort of data foundation right. We still haven't got that quite right. But here at eSanté, I've been hearing very promising things. I was at a talk about Catalan region earlier on and the work that they've done there in adopting open standards and so on. So if we can get that foundation right and build on it and start to consider new ways of doing things with more involvement of the patient, moving away from a sort of two-sided conversation between a doctor and a patient or a healthcare professional and a patient, and maybe more of a three-way conversation between the healthcare professional, the patient, and the data, I think that's when we start to open up whole new avenues of care and stand a chance to meet the challenges.
Great. Thanks for your insight, Keith.
Thank you.
See you next year, I hope.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
If you want to see the keynotes that was referenced in this interview, please head to the eHealth University YouTube channel or follow the university on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is also the place where you can find Keith. All the links are in the description of this episode. See you next time.